This is the Should Have Bet More podcast, presented by Goal Boys Network. Here's your host, Will Hill.
Welcome to the Should Have Bet More podcast, presented by Goal Boys. Solo pod, quickie pod, do a little NBA draft recap reaction, and then segment two, we'll do a little baseball and get you out of here for the weekend. Start with the draft. I don't even want to start with the coverage. I'll get to the coverage, which was just dreadful. Dreadful, especially Wednesday night. Just absolutely awful. But before I get to that, just some takeaways here. It's interesting from a betting standpoint, the draft Wednesday night, round one. Actually, I enjoyed round two. Maybe it's because I had no bets on it. Could just sit back, relax. You get some guys you didn't really think about. For whatever reason, the round two is fun. And I like the fact that they make it its own day. That being said, round one, chalk the first four picks. Then five through seven, it got fascinating and really bet. From a betting standpoint, really, really fascinating. Because if you were monitoring this stuff, monitoring the odds, who's going to go five, who's going to go six, seven, Fears, the kid from Oklahoma, was a monster favorite, and a favorite that moved late. And usually those late moves on the day of a draft are indicative. Somebody knows something, or at least somebody thinks they know something. That ended up being incorrect. Bailey was favored to go six. That ended up being incorrect. And then seven, Queen, the big man from Maryland, he was like odds on to be the seventh pick out of nowhere, really, really late, maybe half hour before the draft. So you figured that was indicative of something, information. Think of the NFL draft, McMillan, his number moved the day of the draft late, and that ended up being accurate and indicative that somebody did have information. But nope, five, six, and seven, all those favorites all go by the wayside. Ace Bailey, the kid from Rutgers, goes fifth. I know these books, they don't want to book it. It's challenging to book it. It's hard to book. It's also hard to bet, which is, they go hand in hand. And they don't want to get beat on information, and they don't want to get beat hanging a long number that shouldn't be long, and it's just not worth it for them. I think there's obviously some laziness involved, and it's not worth it. They'd just rather put up small limits or post it late or not do it at all. That being said, I can't imagine that many bettors did well here. It was a lot of chaos. Once you got past four, and really who's betting Flag and Harper and all these big numbers early. So the chalk probably scares people off. And then the unpredictability sets people's mocks astray. So I would imagine the books did very well. I wonder if they'll reconsider in the future their practices, their habits of just, being difficult about this stuff, being hesitant to book, because I think that they probably had a very successful night. It was a tough draft to bet. A very tough draft to bet, and a lot of randomness, 9, 10, and which that's the thing. One pick goes off kilter, and that sets off a domino effect, and that's what happened with Bailey going fifth. And I did find the humor in Bailey, who, for those people not paying attention, didn't want to play here, wouldn't work out for this team, was very vocal about his preferences, what he preferred, what he didn't prefer. He wanted, he was really making it known where he wanted to go and where he didn't want to go. And for all of those efforts, welcome to Salt Lake City, Mr. Bailey. So I thought that was funny. And I just don't know, as fascinating as it was from a betting standpoint, I don't know how many people listening right now, really care one way or another if Bailey goes to Washington or Utah or Brooklyn or where Jeremiah Fears goes or who Jeremiah Fears is. It just, we don't get that much of a run-up with these kids in college. They're there for 1 year. They're one and done. If they're not a big time team like Duke with Flag, I mean, unless you're a diehard college basketball fan, 80-90% of the people listening haven't seen Jeremiah Fears play. And if you've seen him play maybe once and you remember, it's not like it was way back when these kids were in school for 2, 3, 4 years and you got to know him. You got to know him. You had opinions on him. You were familiar with him. It's just, there's not that familiarity, and it makes it harder to have interest because these are just names faces. I mean, you're vaguely familiar with these guys. So whether they go 6, 7, 8, 9, it's not that interesting from just a general fan standpoint. I did think a couple things jumped out to me. I thought Charlotte actually had a good draft. How about this? Three white guys for Charlotte. They get Kalkbrenner, the second rounder on Friday. They get McNeely, who I think is a good pick. I think that's a steal. He's a winning player. He played for Hurley at UConn. He went way later than I thought. I was shocked he went that late. I think he was supposed to go in the lottery. That's why, I mean, that was That is how he was built, coming into UConn. Hey, this guy's a lottery player. He goes, nearly into the second round, and they get Knipple, who's just, to me, anyone you listen to or read talk about the NBA, Knipple has basically 100% approval rating. Size, shooting, feel for the game. He's not that he's going to be, a 6-7 time All-Star, but he's going to be a very good, productive player in the NBA for a long time. I would say, high floor, high floor. No, very small chance that he's just, average or below average player. He should be a good player. So Knipple, McNeely, and Kalkbrenner. So not that you should be cutting in line to bet Charlotte Hornets futures, but that's a good draft. And keep in mind, with the NBA, if you like a team's draft, it's probably not gonna matter right away. Very few NBA players can come in right away and affect winning. I mean, look at who wins Rookie of the Year. It's guys who put up, 15, 20 points on bad teams. It's just such an adjustment to go from college to the NBA. Even if you have talent, you're not going to really be a positive impact player just because of all the adjustments. Size, physicality, defense. There is a little grace period there where you're really not going to be, impacting winning and losing. Like, Charlotte's not going to just automatically be a good team with these kids. Maybe 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Same thing with Utah, who got Bailey, and we'll see how he works out with Walter Clayton. That's something. That's a possibility of something. See how that develops. I know a lot of people are killing the Nets because they didn't package their picks. They had five picks in the first round and they kept them all. And there was some thought that, hey, you got to do better than this. You got to go up and get the guy you want. Okay. I mean, maybe I understand that. But if you're the Nets, you can also look at it like, we have nothing right now. They had the 8th, 19th, 22, 26, 27. Would you rather have five shots at it with eight being a good pick and then the other one just darts? Or would you rather package it up and feel like you could nail a player and only, transfer that to one or two? I get taking five stabs at it. I mean, look at the Thunder in the finals, the Thunder and the Pacers finals we just watched. A lot of guys, first, second round, later picks, even Haliburton, SGA, they were not, top picks. So I understand once you get in the late 20s, the percentages of getting a really good productive player dip. But I get the fact that, you know what, we'll take five shots at it and we'll take our chances that way. The five picks for the Nets: Demin, Traore, Powell, Saraf, and Danny Wolf, again from Yale, who was at Yale and transferred to Michigan. So Wolf, Saraf, Powell, Traore, and Demin. So I understand. Not exactly the 92 Dream Team. I don't really know who any of those guys are except for Wolf, but we'll see how it plays out. Speaking of guys not knowing who they are, the ESPN coverage. I almost don't want to even talk about it. It's such an easy target. Nobody likes the ESPN coverage. They're so universally disliked that there's no point saying they're bad. Everyone knows they're bad. But to put Perkins on there, to put Stephen A. Smith, these guys don't follow college. Perkins doesn't know anything about these college players. This is not something, analyzing the draft in that setting, where you can fake it. You can't fake your way through that one. You either have a lot of information, a lot of knowledge about these players, or you don't. It's not one where you can just go up there and shoot from the cuff and try to fool people. You either know it or you don't. And he is awful. He is so unprepared. Monica McNutt interviewing people. Malika Andrews is fine. I think the girl Andrea Carter, she's fine. Billis, all right. That's he brings credibility. He covers the college. I don't know why Fran Fraschilla is not involved. I don't know why they do a lot of the things. I mean, they have to somehow parachute Stephen A. Smith in there so he can, just do his little shtick, even though he's not watching college basketball. I don't know how he has time to watch sports. He has 9,000 jobs, but it's a performance with him. It's WWE, and Perkins is his foil. It's really exhausting. It really is. Their coverage has fallen so far, and it makes it tough. It really does. But enjoyed it. Enjoyed it. We'll see what kind of player Flag is going to be. I have not heard one person, I don't think, say, I actually don't think Flag is going to be good. Now, is he going to be an MVP? Is he going to be just like a 6-7 time All-Star and a good player? Like, what kind of player is Flag? Is he a top 10 player? Is he a top three player? I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I feel like it's tough to really, trying to think of the word, project these kids from college, and especially a kid like Flag. I mean, it's just, he's unique. I guess I'll put it that way. I mean, he's going to be good. I'd be shocked if he wasn't at least, again, like three or four time All-Star. But is he going to be like competing for MVP, top five in MVP every year? I'm not sure. He is a big time favorite, as you'd expect, for Rookie of the Year, -185. Harper's 9-1, Bailey's 950, Trey Johnson's 10-1. Knipple 40-1, Fierce 40-1, Demon 40-1. A couple underrated picks. I thought the kid Thero from Arkansas, big guy, leaper, athletic. Him going to the Lakers at 36 is underrated because Luka can throw him lobs. That was really a missing piece to the Laker offense and to Luka's game. He's a perfect fit for that. So that's one that I thought was underrated there in the second round. But you see a lot of names in the second round that didn't go drafted. How about RJ Lewis, the kid from St. John's? Declares early and doesn't get picked. I mean, who told that kid he was an NBA player? That's just horrible, horrible advice as I'm going through these rookie of the year numbers. Flagg's the favorite. He's the rightful favorite. If I wanted to take a shot and say, hey, you can't bet Flagg, pick somebody, take a shot on somebody here. Trey Johnson will score right away, I think. The guy from Washington went to Texas. Knipple 40-1. I don't see a great bet. I really don't see a great bet here. I guess Knipple at 40-1. Not terrible. Not terrible. Again, I think the Hornets did pretty well here. Pelicans gave up a lot to get Queen, so it was okay. It was okay. Again, if you have bets, you're into it. If you don't have bets, I feel like by picks 10, 12, 13, you start drifting to other things and start to lose focus. It is one of those where, if you're still sitting there, pick 16, 17, 18, you're in the minority because it quickly loses its luster. So that's the NBA. When we come back, we'll do some baseball, Mets, Yankees, big picture thoughts around the league. That is next. This Should Have Bet More podcast. All right, we are back. Should Have Bet More podcast. Let's do some baseball. We'll do a lot more baseball here now that the NBA is over. We'll start to look at football. I'll start with the Mets. That was a huge win on Wednesday, and they were able to back it up with another one on Thursday. If they had just given one back on Thursday, it wouldn't have felt great about it. But the fact that they were able to get back-to-back, Atlanta had cut the Mets lead to 7. I know the Mets and Phillies are neck and neck, and I think they will be to the end. But you want to keep an eye on where Atlanta is. And Atlanta got within 7 of you with 2 more games to play. Had Atlanta won Wednesday and Thursday, for as bad as they've been all year, almost at the end of June, they'd only be 5 behind you, and that's scary if you're the Mets. But the Mets win Wednesday. Soto on fire with the bat. Thursday, they get a really well-pitched game, despite the fact that Griffin Canning looks like he blew out his Achilles like the third inning. So he will be done. The Mets continue to lose pitchers. He's been a good story. He's been effective for them. I don't think losing him is the end of the world. It's more just the cluster of losing pitcher after pitcher after pitcher. But bottom line is, I think the Mets are going to be okay. There's a lot of talent. There's a lot of offense. They have enough pitchers. I really think it comes down to the last week and maybe the last weekend between them and the Phillies for this division. I think it's a coin toss. Depends, who stays healthy, who adds players, things like that. Phillies minus 140, Mets are plus 130, Braves are 17-1. So, two really big wins for the Mets. And like I said, Soto, having watched Soto and for the Yankees all last year and just being familiar with him in general, I understand you're probably not going to put up the same numbers he put up at Yankee Stadium, judging all of that. But one of the last guys you ever have to worry about is Juan Soto. He is a tremendous, tremendous, a brilliant offensive player. I know the average was bad. The power was bad. I think I've said a couple times, as the weather warms up, so will he. And he is now just about where you'd expect with the stats. 10 homers in June, 1 million walks. He's fine. I mean, he's 7, 8 years from now. Is that contract going to be good 10 years from now? Who cares? No, but the bottom line is this year, next year, the year after, Soto is a brilliant, brilliant offensive player. And I think Mets Phillies comes down to the wire. Mets Yankees, 4th of July weekend, a week from now, that will be a lot of fun. Speaking of the Yankees, it is no longer a foregone conclusion like it looked like a couple weeks ago that this is just going to be them winning the division and winning it by, margin 8, 10 plus games. They are neck and neck with the Rays. Yankees are only minus 220 now to win the division. Tampa's a spunky club. They got pitching. They are just a resourceful, well-run team, are the Rays. And they always do more with less. They really do. They got derailed a little bit the past couple of years by the fact that Wander Franco, their best offensive player, and who's going to be an absolute star player, he has his legal troubles. He's gone. And Shane McClanahan, Cy Young contender type of guy, he's been out for basically 2 years now. When you're a team like Tampa and you don't have the payroll, you don't have the money, you can't afford to lose your best hitter and your best pitcher. But you look up and they're still doing it. They played extremely well. They win on the margins. They're just a really smart, well-run organization. I don't ultimately think They're going to outlast the Yankees. You probably need to get to 94, 95 wins to win this division. And I wouldn't be shocked if they did. I wouldn't pick them. I don't know that plus 425 is enough. I think the Yankees with Fried, Rodon, that's a pretty good 1-2. Schmidt's decent. You piece together 4 and 5. Warren's not bad. His stuff is pretty. I think the Yankees will be okay. They'll hit enough. They'll probably, add somebody. The bullpen's pretty. I think the Yankees still outlast the Rays. Remember, it was this time last year, they went in a really, really long slump. Came out of it eventually later in the summer and won the division comfortably. I think they'll win the division, but it's something to keep an eye on. Tigers are going to run and hide in the Central, you would think, although Skubal has not looked great recently, but they're still in good shape here to win the division. But Skubal's gotten hit. His velocity's been down, so keep an eye on that. Astros are building up quite the cushion here in the West. Not quite the cushion, but a 6-game lead, that's something. 6.5-game lead, 6 in the loss. Over Seattle, 7 ahead of the Angels. Angels aren't winning this division, and eight over Texas. Texas is going to be a team that you watch. Will they buy? Will they sell? Would they ever trade DeGrom, Eovaldi? They'd have stuff that people would want if they decide to sell. But and they're going to be in a tough spot here to win a division. But if you look at the wild card, you've got the last wild card. Seattle has 39 losses. And then Cleveland outside looking in with 39 losses. Then you got 40, 41, 42, 43. I mean, you've got seven teams within a 4-game margin here of the final wild card, with Seattle being the final spot, then Cleveland, the Angels, Texas, Boston, Minnesota, and the Royals. All, a good week away from being in a playoff spot. Boston has not played well here since the Devers trade. Those kids are probably all going to be good, but Devers was the anchor. Those kids are not ready to be stars yet. They don't play smart Red Sox. I think of Cora, even though I don't like the Red Sox as a Yankee fan, I respect Cora. I think of his teams as always, being disciplined and just well managed. They have not, the times I've watched in the last week or two, bad base running, just bad play. This has been an uncharacteristic Boston year. I know last year they were terrible defensively too. So maybe I'm just have too much respect for Cora, and he does well against the Yankees, and that's just a misperception I have. But Boston has not played well here. And if you look at the American League, the White Sox are out of it. The A's are out of it. Even Baltimore, 12 games under. You think, oh, you're 12 games under. You're already in July. You're done. They're only 7 out. Now, I mean, they've got plenty of issues. There's a reason they're 12 under, but 7 out, that's another situation where a good week, you get hot for a week, you go 6-1, you're right there with everybody else. So there's not going to be a lot of sellers at the deadline. And same thing in the National League wild card. The Rockies are gone, the Pirates are gone, the Nationals and the Marlins are gone. Other than that, San Diego is the final wild card spot with 36 losses. Milwaukee also a wild card spot with 36. And then loser of Philly Mets will get a spot. The outside looking in, San Fran, St. Louis, Cincy, Arizona, all with 39 losses. And then you get to Atlanta, who you got to include there, 7 out in the loss. But that's a bunch of teams. So we'll give Philly Mets loser a spot because both those teams are making the playoffs. You got Brewers, Padres, Giants, Cardinals is 4, Reds, Diamondbacks is 6, 7 teams for 2 spots. So there's just not a lot of sellers, which will make for an interesting deadline. One of these teams on the fringes decides that, hey, we're going to sell here. You might be able to get a lot because it's going to be a market where teams are looking for arms. Like Arizona, for example, if they said, you know what, too many injuries, not our year, we'll trade Gallen. And even, you know what, they could still compete if they traded Gallen because Gallen hasn't been great. So, month or so from the deadline, not that many sellers, which makes things different. I don't like that. I liked it better when it was 4 playoff spots. It was a more traditional. I don't like this NFL of like everybody's 8-8, everybody's in the playoff mix. I don't like that. I like a division of you have your contenders, your fringe contenders, and then you have the teams that are sellers. It makes for a more fun deadline. It shouldn't be everybody has a chance. It shouldn't be 80% of Major League Baseball has a chance to get in the playoffs. And then once you get in the playoffs, anything can. I just don't like that. You play too many games in baseball to have it too random where everybody gets in. One race that's going to be interesting. National League Rookie of the Year has been fascinating. Corbin Burns got called up Saturday night. Chase Burns got called up, the Reds pitcher, last Saturday night at midnight. It was announced he was coming up the following Tuesday against the Yankees. He was 100-1. The next morning, he was 20-1. The second inning of the Yankee game, he was 3-1. He was absolutely dominant against the Yankees. The first couple innings didn't finish the game well. with he got roughed up a little bit in the middle innings, but it's just wild the swings in this. Mizorowski, who's outstanding, the big tall right-hander for the Brewers, he's made three starts, he's allowed three hits, unbelievable stuff. But a guy who's pitched like 15 innings being minus 140 with this much time left to me makes no sense. So I don't know that there's a bet there, but that's a fascinating race. Jacob Wilson, good shape here, American League Rookie of the Year, and the one that's going to be a story I think all summer. Judge was basically off the board to win MVP, minus 20,000, something ridiculous, especially considering the time of year. He's the rightful favorite. I use that term a lot. Cal Raleigh, there's a path. Now, I don't know what that path is. Is it only Judge getting hurt? Does Judge need a big slump? Let's just say Cal Raleigh hits as a catcher 68 homers. 68 homers, but Judge has, I don't know, 50 something, but a better, like, 368 batting average. Does that still go to Judge? Does Judge get the bump because he's in New York on a first place team? Do people get sick of Judge? That's a fascinating possible race here. I still think Judge would get the nod because his numbers are just off the charts. And with Rowley, I know he's a catcher. I know it's a homers. I think there's a little bit of still an edge to Judge, but that's certainly one that's far from over and will be fun to watch all summer. And that could be, sometimes you get these classic MVP debates, these philosophical ones of, what's an MVP? And you get people on both sides. Those are the debates that can be fun. And I could sense that being this kind of race where people say, oh, he's a catcher and he's going to hit 65 or something home runs. And he's got 65, 68 homers is certainly on the table. He's a switch hitter, good defense. Interesting. Interesting. I don't know that I'd bet Cal Raleigh here at the plus 475, but this number has certainly come down. But that's one to keep an eye on. Ohtani minus 10,000 to win National League MVP. I get it. I get it. He's back on the mound. He's Ohtani. Who else do you want to bet here? Soto 30-1, Alonso 30-1. And the baseball writers are not like some of these other writers, like the NBA, where they just get sick of giving it to Jokic, or the NFL, they get sick of giving it to Lamar. They're just going to keep giving it to Ohtani. So my guess is Ohtani would win that award. So baseball is going to be the theme here. Baseball is going to come back into the big picture here as we hit the summer. NBA is over. NFL still got a ways to go. I don't love this Friday card. Mets and Pirates. I actually like the Mets. I think the Mets, like I said, I think that bad spell of baseball is behind them. Soto's hitting. Their pitchers, okay, I know the pitchers being hurt is an issue, but they've got Montas coming back. Manaea's coming back. They got kids in the minors. Their pitchers are almost interchangeable where nobody's great. Everyone's okay. I think they're out of their funk here. Laying $1.65 here against the Mets, against the Pirates. It's a little bit of juice, but wanted to give out some form of a play here. I will give out the Mets. I think they win on Friday. So Mets is a play for me. I don't love this card. You got Dodgers, Royals, Cubs, Astros, an old NL Central matchup, Nationals, Angels, Marlins, Diamondbacks. Not a great card. Not great matchups. And they've been giving us very few afternoon games during the week. It used to be like maybe every other day you get one on a random Monday, a random Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday are travel days. You get a bunch on them. They've really, really cut back on the afternoon day games, which are the afternoon weekday games, which I don't like because space it out. People are home. It's something to break up the day. It's something to watch. For the books, it's good because, standalone games, people will watch, people will bet on it. If it's on 2 in the afternoon, if Tigers and Royals on 2 in the afternoon and it's the only game on, a lot more people are going to bet on it as opposed to it's on 7, 8 o'clock with all the other games. So we will continue to do more baseball, a little quickie mini pod here, NBA draft, MLB. That will do it. We will be back Monday. Rate, review, subscribe, enjoy the weekend. See you then.